Welcome to the 10th episode of Season 4 of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It's Tuesday the 28th of June 2011 as we record, and in this episode we are going to talk about a neat HP microserver and hear an interview with Gemma Caron about Barcamp's Blackpool and Nottingham. We will of course go over the latest news, events, bit about Ubuntu, command line love, and go over your feedback. I'm Mark, and with me this week are Alan.
Hello.
Tony.
Hello.
And guest presenter Andy Piper.
Hello.
Hello, Andy Piper. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
So, Alan, what have you been up to since the last show?
I free-cycled this week. I got rid of a couple of things, batteries and printers, and one of the guys who turned up happened to be a new Ubuntu user.
Wow.
Spooky, right. Huh? And also, I bought a game. Actually, I didn't buy a game. I didn't pay anything for it because it's one of these pay-what-you-like games.
Oh, yeah.
And it's paid nothing.
Well, yeah. the promo video, it's a really nice game. It's called Proun, P-R-O-U-N. I think I'm pronouncing that right, Proun. And it's a Windows game, but it runs under Wine absolutely perfectly on Ubuntu.
Okay.
And the promo video that I saw, it says it's a pay-what-you-like game. You know, that's quite popular at the moment with like Humble Indie Bundle and that kind of stuff. But it says you can pay what you like, even nothing, if you want to. And I thought, well, that's good, because that lets me download it. And if I really like it, then I am going to give the guy some money.
Right.
But it lets me have a play with it first. And also lets me check to see whether it works on Linux.
Ah.
And so I downloaded it and ran the installer, install Wine, out of the box on 11.04. And it runs at full HD 1080p resolution on my screen.
Cool.
No slowdown, 100 frames a second. Brilliant. And it's a lovely, lovely game. I highly recommend it.
Brilliant. Okay. Did you pay any money?
I haven't yet. I only bought it like yesterday or the day before.
Oh, he will. He will. Yeah, he likes it that much.
Yeah, I will.
He's committed to it.
The guy's server's down at the moment because he's the high score tables for the game. It's got like online high score tables. And he didn't realize just how popular it would be. And he said his web hosting was just some cheap and cheerful thing. And he got 1.2 million hits over the weekend on the high score table.
Ooh.
And they took it down and said they're not going to put it back up again. So he's having to find new hosting.
Fair enough.
Tony, how about you?
Nothing very exciting. It's weird having only done this a week since the last one. I haven't done very much.
It's hard enough for you to think of something in 2 weeks, isn't it?
I know, yeah, when you live the dynamic lifestyle that I do. but I did want to just mention the Barcamp interview that we're going to play into the show a little bit later on,
mm-hmm.
That Les Pounder sent in. So thank you, Les, for sending that interview in, recording it and sending it to us.
Mm.
It's quite interesting because it talks about Barcamp Blackpool and Barcamp Nottingham that Gemma runs, but it also reflects on Ogcamp, I think, which is a Barcamp style event. There are Barcamp tracks and the sort of things that go on at Barcamps Nottingham and Blackpool, the sort of things we like to see go on at Ogcamp as well. So bear that in mind when you're listening, I think.
Mm, brilliant.
And I also wanted to remind people about the competition that we started in the last episode, which is to win a copy of Charles Dickens' The Signalman and Other Ghostly Tales in audiobook format by the people at Textbook Stuff. We interviewed Barnaby Edwards. There's a trailer which sounds like this.
I took you for someone else yesterday evening. That troubles me.
That mistake?
No. That's someone else.
The monstrous thought came into my mind as I perused the fixed eyes and the saturnine face that this was a spirit, not a man.
I said, below there, look out, look out. For God's sake, clear the way.
In an old abbey town, down in this part of the country, a long, long while ago, there officiated as sexton and gravedigger in the churchyard one Gabriel Grubb.
Gabriel Grubb! Gabriel Grubb!
I'm afraid my friends want you, Gabriel,
said the goblin.
I'm afraid my friends want you, Gabriel.
The story of the English bride. Basta. One ought not to call so slight a thing a story. Well, it's all one, but it's true.
I find from what I have overheard that mistress is haunted.
How haunted?
By a dream.
What dream?
By a dream of a face.
Ah!
Perhaps I hide the truth from myself, but I do not think that when this began, I meditated to do him any wrong. I stole down after him, creeping under certain shrubs which grow in that place, and none but devils know with what terror I, a full-grown man, tracked the footsteps of that baby as he approached the water's brink. He had hardly spoken the words when a sound resembling a faint groan appeared to issue from the interior of the case. And one of the glass doors, slowly opening, disclosed a pale and emaciated figure in soiled and worn apparel, standing erect in the press.
"Who are you?"
said the new tenant, turning very pale.
"Who are you?"
Charles Dickens, The Signalman and Other Ghostly Tales, read by John Sessions. Visit textbookstuff.com to find out more.
So, if you would like to win that, all you have to do is send in an email to competition@ubuntu-uk.org with the answer to this question. The question is, which novel did Dickens leave unfinished at his death? And you've got until Sunday the 17th of July to send us your entries. So good luck.
And Andy, it's been a while since we've had you on the show.
It is. It was dark the last time I was here outside in the evening, and now it's light.
Yeah, gosh. Not for much longer at this rate.
That's true.
Yeah.
So what have you been up to in the past week or so?
So a couple of things. I finally upgraded my main work machine to 1104.
Uh-huh.
And got over the little hurdles I was going to encounter. I knew I was going to encounter around the upgrade process. Anyway, and I met this lady in the corridor at work. Her name's Laura. I don't know if any of you know her.
Nope.
We know a couple, actually.
Yes, of course you do. And she mentioned that her mum's upgraded to Natty and was having some trouble getting... She couldn't get the Picasa icon to stay in the dock on the side.
Oh, right.
And the problem is that WineApps in Unity kind of launches Wine.exe and they don't kind of absorb.
Yes. Yeah.
So Docky and other dock solutions seem to have worked around this.
Right.
And apparently the Unity launcher hasn't sorted this out fully yet. Now, it's made worse by the fact that Picasa ships its own version of Wine.
Oh, yeah, it comes bundled as a Wine.
So anyway, I thought, well, can't be that hard. Come on, I'll have a go. And anyway, so I sent her a little .desktop file with all the hacks I could manage to work out that would make it sort of-ish work. So I've been kind of pimping my Unity with all the additional lenses launcher things you can do. I mean, there's some nice stuff in the wiki about what you can do. It's a bit manual at the moment, but I'm a power user, right? So, and the other thing is I've got an Android tablet now. I've got a Motorola Zoom. So
ooh.
I have been helping on the Zoom forums, although it's open to anyone who obviously has an Android tablet, to kind of curate a nice list of honeycomb tablet-optimized Android apps because... Mm. The Google market outside of the US, you can't do a search. Well, it doesn't surface the tablet apps as a separate tab, which is quite frustrating.
Oh.
So, we've been kind of curating this list.
Cool.
Which is slowly growing.
I'm glad you mentioned the Unity thing, because I play Minecraft and I run it from the command line because I couldn't figure out how to make it stick in the launcher. So
yeah, you get the little Wine
Java thing.
Yeah, you'll get the Minecraft Java. Yeah, but you'll get for Wine apps, you'll get the like little red wine glass icon appear, which doesn't link up with the launcher you've set up for it. So yeah,
I'll have to look into that.
Slightly annoying.
And Mark, you skived off the last episode.
I'm afraid.
What was all that about?
I was up in Birmingham at a 2-day accessibility hack day. I basically locked in a room with a bunch of geeks and users and various other people who were interested in accessibility and talked about problems and hopefully fixed some problems.
Who would you upset to make that happen?
This was a sort of work-related thing because obviously cool. I do development, so I need to know how to make sure my developments are accessible to everybody who might come along and use them.
Excellent. Sounds like a good time.
Yeah, it was brilliant. It was run by a group called DevCSI, who are all about promoting innovation among developers in the academic sector, and they run some really top-notch events.
Cool. Okay, well, I think we should get on with the show.
Yeah.
Thank you. On the last show, I mentioned that I'd bought an HP ProLiant micro server, and we had a few listeners email in and send us messages on Twitter asking if we could speak a bit more about it. And I believe that Alan's got at least one knocking about in his in his domain. So we thought we'd do a bit of a hardware review.
Haven't done one of those for a while.
No.
Yeah. Okay. So you two have both got one of these things, Mark and Alan.
Yes.
Andy and I do not have one, is that right?
I do not. I was tempted when they first kind of started doing this very exciting deal, and then they vanished off sale for a while because Alan, I think, bought most of the stock.
Yes, I bought them all.
Most of the stock in the Western world. They're
available again. So, yes, tell us about them. They sound exciting.
Well, it's I suppose, good to start by mentioning what this amazing deal is and probably why they became popular quite quickly.
It started in, I think, December or November last year, and I don't know where I saw him mentioned, probably on Twitter, and it was £200-something, not a huge amount of money for a server, and then HP will give you £100 cash back once you bought it, and I thought that sounded like a good deal.
And that deal's been around since December.
And they said it would end at the end of December, I think, and then it kind of disappeared, and they went out of stock everywhere, and then it came back, and it's been back pretty much every month since then.
Yeah.
So what's so good about these things? I mean, who wants a 4U rack server in their living room?
Well, it's basically... Oh, sorry, just knocked my mic stand there. Basically, the reason I wanted one is because I wanted something which would be relatively cheap for me to put a RAID array in, so I've got somewhere reasonably safe to store all my stuff, which I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to be lugging it around on my laptop all the time, and I don't really have anywhere else to put it. And last time I had an external hard drive, it died on me and lost all my data. So I figured I'd have somewhere, you know, somewhere I can store it, but I can still get at it.
Mm. And, okay. Same for me. I wanted a server at home that I could store stuff on. And I've been used to using loads of USB drives, and I was sick of having stuff spread all over USB drives.
And you had a Drobo and things as well.
Yeah, I had a Drobo, but I was kind of unhappy with that. So yeah. I wanted something more flexible.
We won't go into why that makes you unhappy again.
I'm breaking out in sweats already.
So I was being slightly facetious before, because my understanding is it's not a 4U rack-mounted server. It is, in fact, a teeny tiny little shoebox size.
Yeah, it looks like a small desktop PC, like a mini tower.
How does it compare in size to the Drobo?
If you put them side by side, it's, I don't know, about 20-25% bigger in every direction.
Right, okay. Oh, right.
Maybe a bit bigger.
So, yeah, it fits four disks in and then, like, another optical drive on top and has the motherboard slotted underneath.
So it's a bit taller, yeah. So it's probably a bit bigger than that.
Yeah.
When you say disks, are these SAS disks?
Sorry, yeah, SATA. Four SATA disks, yeah.
Yeah, so it comes, the one that we got ships with a gig of RAM, one SATA disk, which is 160 gig, and also has four drive bays. But the one disk you get is taking one of those drive bays.
Oh, right, so you get three free.
Yeah, but the optical bay is empty. So what I did was buy one of those drive mounting kits, and I moved the 160 gig disk into the optical bay because it doesn't come with an optical drive. It's like got a blanking plate over it. So I put the 160 gig in there, and then that gives you four bays in which to put big size disks.
Cool. And then you can RAID them up.
Yes. It's got RAID built into the motherboard, or you can use software RAID.
It's fake RAID.
Yeah, I tried using it, and I thought I was really happy with myself that I got it all set up, and I booted into Ubuntu, and it just showed me
some disks.
I was like, oh.
It's one of those ones where you need the Microsoft Windows-y bits to make the BIOS stuff work, right?
It's supported on Linux.
Oh, it's supported on Linux.
It's called, really confusingly, the Linux software RAID is called MD RAID, and this fake RAID, I think, is called DM RAID.
Right. Nice.
Yeah.
Sends you messages on Twitter.
Yes. So so I've chucked 4 2-terabyte disks in mine, and so it's full of lots of disks, and it's also got USB ports and VGA
ports on
and
the back as well.
Yeah, it's
if got you want to expand it further.
Yeah. And what CPU's got has it got in it?
It's a little AMD Athlon low power. It's actually, I think, a laptop processor.
Yeah,
it so does. There's not a fan on the CPU.
No, it's just passively cooled with the server fan pulling air through the whole case, and it does dynamic scaling as well, so that helps conserve a bit of power as well.
So what speed is that running at? Not that it matters so much, I guess, on a server.
I think mine, when it's idle, is 1 gigahertz, and it goes up to 2.2 maybe, but I think that might be a lie. It might be, I think it might be nearer 1.6.
Yeah, well, according to my Byobu little monitor thing, most of the time mine's running, it's dual core, I think,
or hyper-threading, I'm not sure. It's running at 0.8 gigahertz and then goes up to 1.6,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, I think you're right, actually. I may be thinking of another machine. Yeah, 0.8 up to 1.6, and it is dual-core, not
right.
hyper-threading.
Right, one, okay. one of Alan's many servers in his server room runs at a far faster speed.
Yeah.
It sounds like with the not particularly stellar CPU and not an overly generous amount of RAM. I mean, for the price, it's brilliant, but you know, it's not a huge amount of RAM. It's really all about the disks. It's all about essentially using it as a NAS device, a network-attached storage.
Yeah, and if you were the kind of person that wanted to like chuck one disk in it, and then you know when you filled it up with photos or video, you know, you could put Samba on there, for example. So, you know, it's obviously a PC, so it will run Ubuntu server. And then you could chuck all your extra stuff like a media server, like, I don't know, something like Mediatome or Tonki or whatever, or and then Samba to share your stuff out. Then as soon as you fill that up, chuck another disk in and another disk and, you know, away you go.
Presumably if you're swapping disks out, you have to do migration of data and things. It's manual rather than...
It's not got any intelligence.
Yeah.
It's not like a Drobo where you can pull disks out and monkey them around. It is reliant on you to manually set up RAID. But that's not so painful during the Ubuntu server install. It's you know, it's possible to do that.
Okay. And other stuff that's on board, PCI slots or anything, can you actually do anything with it other than disks?
Yeah. It comes with a gig of RAM.
Yeah.
Is it two slots?
There's two slots. It can hold up to 8 gig, which given the processor, I'm sure that's more than sufficient for anything you'd actually do with it.
Yeah.
And then it's got two, I think it's got one PCI slot and one PCIe slot, is it?
No, they're both PCIe.
They're both PCIe, right.
One's like x1 and one's a x4 or
right,
something.
Right, and
like
they're
that.
Both half height. So you can
Yeah, they're very short.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what sort of things could you put those to? So I'm presuming it's already got a network socket on board.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's got an Ethernet port. So I guess you could add, if you wanted it to be your gateway device.
Right, okay.
Or, have multiple network ports on it. You could chuck a little multi-Ethernet device in there.
Yeah.
How about something like another SATA card with external ports on it so that you could connect?
Yeah, that's actually what I've done on mine because one of the limitations...
I genuinely didn't know that. That sounds really fake and set up.
One of the problems with the onboard eSATA port is that it doesn't do port multiplying external arrays.
Right.
So, for example, if you buy an empty... external SATA enclosure
that
you put multiple disks in, it will only have one SATA cable that connects it to the host, and the host will only see one drive. It won't actually see all of the drives, so only one of them spins up, which is a bit of a pain. But all of the cheap onboard eSATA ports are generally like that.
Yeah.
But my unit, I got an Edge 10 external drive array, came with a PCI card, and the PCI card had a full height back plate on it.
Yeah.
And I looked in the box and actually there was also a half height back plate.
Oh, nice.
It's only a half height card. So I unscrewed the back plate, screwed on the half height one, put it inside, and now I've got two extra port multiplying ports. So I could chuck another four discs and another four discs in it. And I'm laughing.
Okay. So what are you two using yours for? Mark, you gave us a little bit of an overview, but is there anything other than just file storage?
I'm also using mine as a web server for I'm basically trying to see what cloud services that I use that I can run myself. So, you know, we've been interviewing like the guys from Own Cloud and Synchrony in the last couple of shows. I decided to sort of try and dog food it, see what I could actually do myself. I put Own Cloud on it and it works.
Okay.
And I've been playing around seeing if I can replace Google Docs with something. At the moment, the best I've done is Drupal with a load of plugins. Which I've actually managed to do a surprising amount with. I've got it doing something I can take notes on, some spreadsheets and presentations. And I've got Roundcube webmail running on it because I was fed up with desktop email clients that always crash on me.
Have you tried Evolution?
I was joking. Oh, my God. At the moment I'm looking for something that would... some sort of photo management thing that I can upload to from my phone. But... part of the problem with that is the fact that I've only got a self-signed SSL certificate on it, and Android applications don't often cope with that as well as they might. But yeah, basically, I'm using it to run web applications and for backups and stuff.
Has it got enough RAM for that? It doesn't struggle?
Yeah.
Or?
No, not really. The only time I've really noticed it struggling so far, other than loading some of the more complicated pages on Drupal, is doing like things like apt updates and things like that.
Right.
Well,
so,
I mean,
if they're intensive ones. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you don't really need. I mean, I used to run a home server with, I think, 768 or whatever the relevant multiplier of RAM was, right? So unless you're really heavily pushing the thing with lots of connections on Apache, you're not going to really run out of RAM on that kind.
Especially if you're one user.
Exactly, yeah. That's the point. Yeah. So for an individual user, that's going to be perfectly adequate. So you say you use it for media storage and stuff as well.
Well, it's not. I don't stream off it or anything at the moment. I just use it to put stuff on and access it over like network shares.
Right, because one of my use cases, I guess, for having that kind of storage at home is things like streaming to my Revo for the media stuff, and then having a load of content for iTunes. Yes, unfortunately, on there as well, and that's a nightmare actually, because the file structures are such a pain for iTunes and trying to make that work happily with everything else.
I do have media on mine, but it's mostly actually stuff that I just download from BBC iPlayer, and I just have it sitting in a directory and it's shared out via Samba.
Yeah,
and pretty much everything can get to that.
Yeah,
and
that's what I've done
just
before.
Open files up and I just open them up in whatever media player happens to be on whichever machine is there at the time, and that seems to work all right.
Yeah, I've done it before, just having just video files on a Sam share hooked up to laptops, my Wii, things like that, and it just sort of works.
What I also use mine for is remote backups. So I use a tool called rsnapshot to go off and get a backup of a bunch of remote machines, including my VPS at Bitfolk, and also all of lug.org.uk is backed up onto it. And I do that every 4 hours and do a like hourly, daily, monthly, you know, thing that our snapshot does. And it's okay. The only problem with it is because of the vast amount of I/O required to do our snapshot when it's doing diffs of a whole file system that's got a bazillion little files, like a mailman mailing list is going to have that's been there for 5 years.
Yeah.
It chugs a bit because there's a lot of I/O, and I've tried to tune it, and as I mentioned last time, I've asked a bit on the internet and tried to get it as best as I possibly can and had some good tips, but I think I'm reaching the boundaries of what's possible with those SATA disks. I don't think the box is necessarily being pushed. I think it's I/O.
So you're both running Ubuntu on it, I assume?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. LTS. Yes.
Was that installed? You said it hadn't got the optical drive, so
it was
by
blank.
USB? Or?
Yeah, it was blank when I got it.
Yeah, same thing.
And I used a USB key.
Cool. Yeah.
But the only gotcha, actually, worth noting is
it doesn't work.
Is I put Ubuntu server on a USB key, plugged it in, and did the install. And at the end, it put grub on the USB key and not on the hard drive.
Clever.
Because by default, it went to SDA, and SDA at the time of boot was the USB key, which was a bit duff.
But you were able to fix that?
Yeah, grub, you know, reinstall grub.
So that's right USB 2 slots on it, I assume, because I can't...
Yes.
I'm not on this. I mean, obviously, it's not related to this machine specifically, but I have had some interesting challenges getting USB 3 to boot and install Ubuntu.
Oh, right. Yeah. No, they're USB 2 on the front. I think they're USB 1 on the back.
Right.
But the back ones are the ones I think you have to use for the keyboard. If you plug a USB keyboard.
Because there's no... PS2 ports. You have to have a USB keyboard, as I found out, not owning a USB keyboard.
Oh, yeah. That's why you asked to borrow a USB
keyboard. The other gotcha I found was creating the USB disk on the... I think I was creating it on the latest release. I forgot what it's called. Natty. Creating it on Natty, but with Lucid Image. For some reason... when it tried to boot, it got to the prompt and then failed. So I then just had to type in install or Linux install or whatever. Right. Get
Did
it
you
working.
Use UNET booting or or the USB startup disk creator thing that comes?
I think
with
the USB startup disk creator.
Yeah, thing. I've had problems with that. I find UNET booting is a lot more reliable.
Right,
it's very nice because you get to choose which distro as well, exactly what you want
to
download.
Yeah,
it just goes, give me the latest, or you know, latest. Live version or whatever, so yeah, it's great.
It's worth also mentioning that it does actually have a 3D capable VGA card in it.
Oh wow.
It's got an ATI card, so it can actually run
a
composited desktop. You could actually use it as a desktop PC.
You could use it for Unity, awesome.
Cool. Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Well, it sounds like this is the 2011 version of the Viglen MPCL that
absolutely.
We gave away back in season one. Yeah. So if you listen in the next episode, we've got one of these lovely things to give away. Thanks to Alan.
All shiny, in its box, untouched by human hand.
Absolutely. So
just as well.
Tune in
or mine.
Tune into episode 11 and find out how you can win.
time for the news, and Veronix are reporting a possible culprit and potential fix for the power problems in the recent Linux kernels. Since 2.6.38, which shipped with Ubuntu 11.04, it's been widely known that battery performance has been noticeably worse than previous releases. Veronix is reporting a patch by Matt Garrett as a possible cause.
Oh dear.
The angry Matt Garrett.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it looks like the workaround is just a simple boot flag in your grub.
Oh, right.
And everyone wins. Better battery performance, but we'll have to wait and see when there's more testing. They've Veronix and some other guys have done some testing already.
The article's quite interesting. It talks a lot about their setup for monitoring power usage and finding which patch might have caused the problem and stuff. So it's worth a read for that alone.
Yeah. Apple is showing its trademark defending muscle by sending a cease and desist notice to Amahi, the home server project, over its use of the term App Store. Amahi have responded by running a Name the Store contest.
Yeah, this is because they're trying to defend their patents because somebody else is suing them, or they're suing somebody else.
Yeah, they're suing Amazon, and they need to prove that they are generally defending it to show that it's a valid trademark.
Oh, because Amazon have an Android app store.
Yes. And I think Amazon, I think the last I heard, and this is, I'm not a lawyer, but the last I heard, I think, was that the judge was kind of indicating to Apple that they may be about not to get things decided in their favour unless they could really prove that they were defending it more.
Wow.
You know, they really owned it.
Well, that'd be good. Because the term does seem fairly genericised, you know.
I don't even like the term.
No, I know.
Well, it's like podcast, isn't it? It's kind of stuck. Oh, yes.
One fun thing on the Amahi website is now their link that used to say App Store now just randomly goes through user-submitted names every time you load the page.
That's kind of fun.
And dangerous.
Firefox's new rapid release cycle has been criticised for making life difficult for those wishing to deploy Firefox in businesses. Asa Dotzler of Mozilla has responded to comments by saying that enterprise support isn't Mozilla's primary concern.
Yeah, upsetting quite a lot of corporate people.
Yeah.
It's all to do with their new release cycle, where they release every 6 months and it's a whole
six weeks,
and it's a whole new version and they stop supporting the old version.
Yeah, so that's five just came out and they stop supporting four.
That's the critical part. They're no longer going to issue security patches on 4. 4 is essentially immediately end of life and it's automatically upgraded for everyone. So if you're working for a big business that's rolled it out to several hundred thousand employees, then you might care about security fixes on something.
But you say automatically rolled out, surely that's at the decision of the administrators of the network.
It's actually the decision of the user, isn't it? Because you get the pop-up saying there's a new version of Firefox.
Assuming you're allowed to. It could be
locked down. I'm pretty sure you could stop.
Maybe that's the case with Firefox,
But even then, would you want to run an old, unsupported release?
If you're running Chrome, it's just going to do all that for you anyway under the covers. But then how many enterprises are using Chrome? So that's another discussion.
Well, I don't think it is fairly straightforward. My daughter uses Chrome on a Mac, which is parental controlled, and that doesn't auto-update.
Oh, really?
Oh, really?
Yeah, because it can't get to the website that has the Google updates on it.
Ah, okay.
Because the parental controls don't let her. So it's pretty trivial. All you got to do is set all your enterprise to be controlled like a seven-year-old girl, and you're sorted.
And then, of course, you get no security updates, so as soon as a vulnerability is discovered, your entire enterprise is vulnerable.
Well, you just limit everyone to visiting CBeebies and nothing else.
Oh, I see. Sorry. Yes,
there's ways around all
right,
of this.
I get it, yeah.
Alan, the security expert.
Two-fifths of OSWatch, the open-source software advice service based at the University of Oxford Computing Services, have left to form Open Directive. The new company will work to promote open innovation, helping new developments in the academic research centre find commercial partners to bring their ideas to market.
Now, this is interesting. Janet and Jisc are one of those organisations that's been quite heavily hit by some of the funding cuts.
Yes.
So is this them trying to make a bit of a commercial go of one of their operations?
Essentially, yeah. The funding for OSWatch has been declining, as I understand it, and the so two of the guys are basically saying, well, we can provide some of the services funding from the private sector.
Yeah, fair enough.
So
could be good. I mean, what other projects, other than the only one I know that's come from academia is Zen, like large open source projects.
The internet.
Well, okay, yeah.
Dasher.
Yeah, I kind of meant the UK.
Yeah. Well, Tim Berners-Lee.
All right.
It's Conservative
Party. Is he an open source project?
Yes.
Where's the source code?
You can patch him. Conservative Party advisor Liam Maxwell, author of a 2009 report promoting the use of open source in government, has been appointed to advise the coalition on the use of ICT.
Which could be good news.
Could be good news.
Let's hope so.
Could not, you know. Bastard.
I've not seen any of his work, so I'll wait until I have seen it.
Yeah, well, hopefully he will continue to support open source in his new role.
And now a couple of events. The UK Loco team are having what they affectionately call a Books and Butties Day. And for those who don't know, a butty is a sandwich. on the 24th of July from 10 a.m. till 3 p.m, starting at the British Library in London and moving on to somewhere green for a geek picnic, a geeknik.
The British Library is very nice. I'm not sure where the nearest green space is there. But.
Yeah, not necessarily in there, but maybe move, you know, a short way, Hyde Park, Tube Ride or something.
Specifically, there's a sci-fi exhibition at the British Libraries.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's what's interested a few people. Go along, see the exhibition, and then go and have a picnic in a field and have a bit of fun.
Well, that sounds like fun. Mm. And there'll be a link in the show notes where people can find out more.
Yes.
And, of course, the event you all want to hear about, Og Camp, is, of course, happening at the Farnham Meltings in Surrey on the 13th and 14th of August.
Yay!
Very soon.
Yes.
Scarily soon.
At the point we release this, it'll be just 5 weeks to go, and that's just two episodes of this show left before the actual thing. Man.
There's a remarkable amount of hair on display still. Yeah. But for the people, you know.
I have mine cut, so you can't see the grey hair. That's
Each one cut out in turn. We need to thank Bitemark for sponsoring the event. They are our primary sponsor, and they've coughed up the most money to get us there, and without them it really wouldn't be happening. So thank you very much indeed, Bitemark. But we've also had sponsorship from Chris Proctor on behalf of log.org.uk, so thank you, Chris.
And the Evening Do, which is happening on the Saturday.
Yeah.
Yes.
Got that right. Is being sponsored by Bitfolk.
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 Their Russian equivalent.
Yes. And some people who want to save on hotel costs have decided to Og Camp, quite literally.
Yeah.
They're going to be camping somewhere in a field near Surrey. So if you're interested in doing that, if you contact ogcamping@gmail.com, you can find out more details.
There are still a few tickets left, just under 30 at the moment. Mm. So got time still to book a ticket if you haven't already done so, and come along to what's going to be a fantastic sort of weekend of people bringing along talks, some scheduled speakers and some kind of just random impromptu talks. If you want to meet up with like-minded people and hear some cool stuff, then come along. It really Absolutely. Is worth it.
Are guest presenters allowed on the traditional episode of the podcast that you record at Og Camp? I can see they're
Depends
considering this.
Being any sort of, you know, anybody gets run over by a bus or
filled in the forms.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, there's so much paperwork to do. But yeah, hopefully you'll all come along. Andy, you're coming along as well, aren't you?
I certainly am, yes. Yeah. It's going to be my first Og Camp. I'm very excited.
Excellent. So we'd like to hear, and we're all going to be there. So we'll see you there.
So it's time for Command Line Love, and this particular command is something that I noticed after the last episode, because it was around password expiry time in the company I work for. So let me just explain. So if you're a user in a big business company like me, where we've got expiry policies, or if you just like to have your own kind of set up your password expiry so that you're regularly changing it to be nice and secure, of course we all do, right? We're always changing our passwords. So you may have set up password expiry. Now, the only problem I find with that is that when I log in, within a sort of the five-day window before it expires, it does tell you in the login window.
On Ubuntu.
But does you will never notice. Oh. It literally just flashes up as you log into the desktop. So it kind of vanishes before you even have a chance to realize.
Oh.
And sometimes you do notice, but you just can't read the number. So I thought, well, hold on a minute. It must be possible to find out when my password expires. And there is a really simple command. It's just a Unix command. So if you go to the command line and type expiry minus C, it will tell you the number of days until your password expires.
I just did that, cool. And it didn't do anything.
Have you got password expiry set up for your account?
No.
You see, if I type expiry minus C right now
on your corporate laptop,
it doesn't say anything. That's a problem. Maybe it only says, oh, no, that's a good one. Maybe it, oh, fail. Maybe it only tells you if you're within the expiry window.
They said together.
Or I'm just completely wrong.
It's like a little chorus. Or maybe when it's got the network connection up to check against whatever LDAP service.
Yeah, but mine isn't doing that. Mine is a local password file. Yeah.
So I just pulled up the man page for expiry. It's a very simple command.
Yes, it is.
It has two options, and it says the expiry command checks
make it work.
The current password expiry time and forces changes when required. That's it. That's cool.
Well, I can assure you that when I had that problem about 2 weeks ago, just after the last episode was recorded, I typed expiry minus C and it said 3 days or whatever it was.
Oh, that's cool.
So, is there a bug filed about the fact that it doesn't show on the login screen?
I'm not sure, actually.
We should file that.
Friend of the show, Andy Stanford Clark, and I have discussed this problem before because we have this. We obviously have the same corporate setup. So it's quite annoying.
Cool. Well, like it.
Both file bugs then. Mm. And that's the end of the command line love.
Okay, this afternoon I'm here with Gemma Cameron, who's the queen of the bar camp, I do believe. Gemma, can you tell me a bit more about what is it you do?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm the queen of bar camps. I'm maybe the queen of Bar Camp Blackpool. I've organised 2 Bar Camp Blackpools, and I'm organising another one this year, and Bar Camp Nottingham would be the first one in the East Midlands. Got started with it all probably about 2006, 2007. Started going to Geek Up. Geek Ups are a meetup or for geeks. And I started finding out about bar camps. Went to my first one in Manchester. I cannot remember when that was, but it was the very first Manchester one. Mm-hmm. And it just blew my mind. It was amazing to go along to this place for free. We went on a Saturday, turned up to this massive room full of geeks, full of other developers. Yeah. And everyone just learning and knowledge sharing and learning stuff, not from people who are paid to speak, but people who actually do this day to day. It's just absolutely fascinating. And then there was a few pizzas brought in for the after party and more drinking, which was very, very fun.
But you've got an eclectic mix of people, haven't you? It isn't just typical one group of developers, such as web developers. You have got quite a mix of people there, haven't you? You've got, let's see, web developers that I know, software developers. You've got mobile application developers.
You haven't just got developers, though. You've also got designers. You've got photographers. You've got people who are just sort of self-confessed geeks, people who aren't interested in geekery at all. Anything that you've got something to talk about that you're quite passionate about. If the best talks are usually ones that aren't actually technical as well. I do talks about my ferrets and roller derby. We've got Lally, who comes along to Blackpool, and she gives an introduction to the British Sign Language. The sessions, again, they can be on absolutely anything. It all depends on who turns up on the day. And the more eclectic a mix of people you get, the more information, the more expertise, and the more fun stuff that you get. The sessions also aren't just talks. They can be discussions. They can be somebody trying to get some ideas and opinions on a new concept they've come up with, or trying to find out more information, or doing a workshop. Absolutely anything.
Yeah. What do you think is the appeal of a bar camp to people? Is it just the mix of people, or is it something else?
Generally, it's the free booze. I think...
Good answer.
I think with it being free and it being different to a normal conference, like I say, where you have to pay a lot of money and the people who come along are seen as experts in the field and they're paid to go around the world and speak, this is a bit more grassroots. Getting to meet these people who do this day to day and they've been learning and teaching themselves and learning from other people, getting to choose, because there's always at least 3 talks going on at once, so you get to see which one to go to. A lot of the time you're torn. The Sheffield one, my last bar camp I went to, I was torn in 3. I wanted to go to all of them. Bar camp sessions are quite short as well, but usually the speaker's on for about 20 minutes, more like a lightning talk style-y, whereas a conference they might be talking for at least an hour. All attendees are generally expected to bring a talk with them. If that puts people off, we always say you don't have to bring one, but try and bring one with you, because you'll always end up changing your mind once you've seen your first talk. It's a lovely place to try out public speaking. Everyone's so friendly and welcoming. They help you get the information out and they ask you the questions. It's nothing, no one's trying to shoot you down. Everyone's trying to help and everyone wants to learn. It's just a really nice place to be, a really nice atmosphere.
So Bar Camp Nottingham is going to be on the 23rd and 24th of July, which isn't far away now,
is it?
It's
very exciting. I'm going to be away for a couple of weeks, so when I get back next month, it's going to be all go. organising that. We're pretty much done. We've got the venue sorted out, which is going to be at the Nottingham Hackspace. I'm really looking forward to having it there. It's a huge, beautiful old building behind the ice arena. And we've got a massive space. We can split it all up into different rooms. The benefit of it being a community space is that we can be there as long as we want. So we're going to have it as a whole, a 30-hour bar camp.
Wow.
So it's an all-nighter rather than being an overnighter, because there's a lot of hoops you have to jump through if you're wanting to make somewhere safe for people to sleep overnight. Forget about sleeping, just turn up, bring your Red Bull, crack on, work on through. really, really excited. It's going to be East Midlands' first bar camp. Like Blackpool is Lancashire's first bar camp. I'm expecting us to get a huge amount of people. There's already so much going on in Nottingham. It's a really vibrant city with lots of tech groups. I mean, I run Geek Up. I help run the Nottingham Girl Geek Dinners with Kate. We also have a Nottingham Digital Community, which gets all the other organisers along. So there's Not Tuesday, Second Wednesday, there's the Tuttle, the Cocoa Heads, there's a developers meetup. There's a lot going on and a lot of people that it'd be great to get all these different groups together. So not all of them are developers. There's people there who are technical entrepreneurs or, you know, just label themselves as being a bit geeky or have a real interest in certain areas. So I think this will be a great, great mix, and it'll be new people that haven't been to bar camps before. You obviously get the usual suspects coming along that go to every single bar camp. And we've got quite a few people signed up from around the country coming along. All the people that that go to the Hackspace, that are Hackspace members, they're all going to be there as well. So I think it's going to be interesting getting them all in a room with some booze and...
I wish I was there. Now, I know that where you're at, the Hackspace, recently, that's just moved location, hasn't it? It used to be near the train station.
Yes, it did. They had a few problems. The people that are renting it off had to close the whole building down. It was really conveniently located, but they've now got, thanks so much to all the people who donated, but thanks to those people, they were able to get up a deposit to move into much bigger and better premises. It's still just in Nottingham city centre. It's... just a bit further from the train station, so it's behind the ice arena. But again, you've got beautiful big old mills around that area because it was all the sort of lace market and sort of during the Industrial Revolution, you've got these beautiful big buildings that are now empty and they've got a fantastic space to allow us to do things like bar camps, and they obviously have their open days and do all their hacking there.
So... it's going to be on the 23rd and 24th of July. What time do the doors open on the 23rd?
I think the doors are opening at 10 o'clock. We decided if we do a little bit of a later start, people appreciate that. And with it being all through the night, we're going to keep the talks going until a bit later as well. Some bar camps open the door at 9 and they stop the talks at 5. We're going to try and delay it a little bit. Have lunch as well. Hopefully, if we've got sponsors, lunch will be provided. Dinner, breakfast... drinks, food through the night, things like that will hopefully all be provided. If not, we are in the city centre. There's lots of shops around. We can get takeaway ordered in for people. And so we've kind of got a nice free reign. We really, really appreciate Hackspace allowing us to use that their space. And you can go to bcnot.co.uk. So bcnot.co.uk. You can get your tickets. They're all readily available. We're still looking for sponsorship if anyone wants to get in touch with me. I'm at ruby_gem, or it's Gemma with a G, gemma.cameron@gmail.com.
Right. Well, on to your second bar camp, which is the one that I've been to on two occasions now, which is Bar Camp Blackpool.
Yeah.
In the town that has many donkeys and many pies.
A massive tower. I love Bar Camp Blackpool. There's the people who come along. We have regulars, the people from Geek Up Press who are involved around there, but a lot of people have a big love for Blackpool. They say if you turn up on the Friday, you check into your B&B, turn up for Bar Camp Blackpool, which is in a beautiful, beautiful venue. We do have to raise quite a lot of sponsorship because it's in this casino at the Pleasure Beach. They take really good care of us. we're in the Paradise Room. So you come to go into the Pleasure Beach itself, and you go into the ticket office where you'd normally buy tickets, and go up, you arrive at this beautiful Art Deco hotel sort of space, go up these stairs, walk through these doors, and you're there in the Paradise Room, which has got a beautiful big stage, got blue fairy lights all over the ceiling. They've got partitions, so we break the room into three, so we have a big space in the middle. There's booths at the back for people to sit in. There's Wi-Fi. We have the lovely Alistair who always sorts out the Wi-Fi, and a view over the Pleasure Beach, over Blackpool. At lunchtime, we are going to definitely have the pies bag. We had everybody go outside and queue up for these pies, from hot pies from a van last time. Everyone, I think the Southerners were a little bit confused by these pies, but everyone else seemed to really enjoy them.
I know my mate turned up just in time to get his pie voucher.
Oh, did he?
Got it, came straight downstairs. He come all the way from Liverpool, and he's probably going to listen to this. It's Dan Lynch from the Linux Outlaws podcast. He literally turned up, went, hiya, oh, pie voucher, went outside for his pie straight away. He's a proper northerner.
I always did, you see. Yes, we have a nice big board at the back as well, so we split the room into three last time. We ended up having to make more areas, didn't we, because we had many people wanting to talk. So we're going to modify it a bit this year, probably have shorter sessions and have more of them. And we always have a nice after party because we've got this beautiful space. It's got this big stage and they've got lighting and PA system and stuff. We had a magician the last couple of years, so we might mix it up this year and see if we can get some other entertainment in. Either that or people are going to just do the usual PowerPoint karaoke, maybe bring some consoles, put them up on a big projector, and definitely Werewolf.
Barcamp Blackpool, it's grown over the years, hasn't it, really? Not the actual event itself, the event's in the same place, but your attendees, it has gone from, I think the first one was about, was it 40-something or maybe 50-something attendees?
We had about 50 people. We had about 90 people sign up the first year and about 50 on the day. Last year we had 150 tickets allocated and we had 120 people turn up.
That's a lot of pies.
It was. I was stunned. It was so good to be able to provide something for all these people and have them all turn up. And the tickets get snapped up. We sold out of tickets. I had a waiting list. And I think it's going to be exactly the same this year. The word has definitely spread that Barcamp Blackpool is something special. I put it down to the Pleasure Beach. Blackpool itself is a very special place.
Right, so Barcamp Blackpool is going to be on Saturday the 15th of October, is that right?
Yep. Tickets are not on sale yet, but keep your eyes peeled. Follow BC Blackpool on Twitter. Keep an eye on the website, barcampblackpool.com, and we'll let you know. I think it'll be just after Nottingham, so I can start gearing up. And again, we're still looking for sponsorship for Barcamp Blackpool. It's really important that we get sponsorship for that because we have to pay for the venue and for food.
Yeah. Gemma, so, sponsorship for the events. So who do you want to be your sponsors?
We've had sponsors in the past, such as PayPal and Yahoo, Microsoft, but we've had quite a few people who have local businesses who are very interested in sponsoring as well, and I'd love to get more local businesses involved just so that they can really keep in touch and really get to know the people in the community, so the local community and the tech community. These are the people that they need to be reaching out and talking to. The sponsorship money, say, goes towards things like the venue and food and things like that. In turn, you get put in front of all these people. So if you're wanting to reach out to developers and to designers and technical people, then this is a really great way of you to do that very cheaply. We also advertise it a lot online. Not just the people who turn up on the day, there's a whole build-up to it online. A lot of people who can't perhaps make it, they all take an interest and follow the tweets, look at all the blog posts afterwards. So, in return for your sponsorship, depending on the level, we'll tweet about you, tweet thank you, we'll put some, put your logo on the website, we'll talk about you in the opening and closing speeches at Barcamp. We can, if we get sponsorship money for T-shirts, we'll put your logo on the back of the T-shirts, things like that.
For the events, do you need anything else apart from sponsorship? Do you need any equipment or people to help out or any freebies?
The main thing that people like from a bar camp is swag. So if your company hasn't got cash to maybe give or want to get their name out to all the attendees, give us some merchandise, give us cups, give us pens, stickers, absolutely anything. We'd really like some swag.
Right, well, I'll just do a quick recap then. So we've got Bar Camp Nottingham, which is 23rd and 24th of July in Nottingham's Hackspace. And we've got Bar Camp Blackpool, which is Saturday the 15th of October at Blackpool
Pony Beach. It'd be lovely, really lovely to get some new faces there, and hopefully some of the listeners will pop along, or at least following it online.
That's all the questions. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Les.
It's time for the bit about Ubuntu.
Gerald. I was disappointed that Andy didn't come in with that as well.
He's got to be on top.
I was the one that reminded you before.
You were, yes. I was looking for that validation.
Sorry.
And the ecosphere. So Ubuntu developers apparently have removed the Synaptic Package Manager from the 11.10 default install.
The sky is falling.
Outrageous.
This is the end of Ubuntu.
This is the worst thing that happened since they moved the buttons from one side to the
other. Yes, and they removed the
Did
game.
They move buttons? When? What?
You don't remember that? Oh, dear. So this is the end of Synaptic, thanks to the Ubuntu Software Center.
Oh, well.
Well, okay. I can see why some people want to keep it, but personally, I have pretty much never used it other than when someone says, how do you do this in Synaptic? And I open it and then look at it and think, now I know why I don't use this.
Yeah, I was going to say, hold on a minute, didn't they remove this? The last release, but actually that was aptitude, and I'm getting myself confused, and I kind of weaned myself off of using the aptitude commands to apt-get, because I'm pretty much a command line person anyway. Mm-hmm. I have used Synaptic occasionally.
I always struggled with it, whereas I've never struggled with the Software Center.
No. Mm.
It's not the most usable tool, in my opinion, but
it's featureful, nice, yes, you know, correct. And there is a feature that it has that I have never used, but I keep seeing people ask questions about and recommend that to them. And that is, if you've got two computers and one's online and one's offline, and you want to get updates on the offline one, or you want to install software on the offline one, you can go into Synaptic, mark things as I want to install this, and then there's an option under the first menu which will generate a script that you run on the machine that is online, and then you doubly get the files and bring them across. Which is quite handy, but
didn't you criticise the way that you could do the depackager aptitude thing before? When on the
This is slightly different.
This is cooler, is it? Yeah, better at work.
This is okay.
Don't get the craft.
Yeah, this is not rubbish.
Cool. What's up next, Andy?
Nice try.
Steelstorm brackets game is now available for $2.99 in the Ubuntu Software Center.
Yeah, I put the game in there because I know none of you play games, so I just wanted
games
to make
Excuse
that
me.
Clear.
Excuse me. Just because I don't buy a Windows license so I can do so doesn't mean I don't play games.
Now, we should just clarify that this is a sale price until July the 5th, after which the game rises in price to $10.
Wow.
I think that's good. I mean, you look at the success of things like the Android Marketplace and the Apple App Store in terms of 59p, £2 games. They're insanely successful, the good ones. And there's loads of them. There's a proliferation of them. And if we can get more of that kind of market, then you get people just clicking, and that money goes to Canonical and helps support the development of Ubuntu and goes to the developers who make the game and makes them realize that Linux is a viable platform for gaming.
And this was always coming, wasn't it, when we were talking to MPT in your kitchen one time, Alan, for an episode.
I think you mean Studio B.
Yeah, sorry, that's what I meant, with its own dishwasher. Yes. It was obviously clear at that point that they were looking to make this available in future.
Oh, totally, yeah. I mean, it's always been, it's not called a software center. You wouldn't,
It was called Software Store originally.
It was originally, but, it's pretty obvious.
So, Alan, as a seasoned gamer, perhaps you'd like to tell us a little bit about the features and the type of game that we're talking about. Is this a Tetris-style puzzle game?
Well, we don't have time to give you a full review, and also I've not played it, but I have seen a YouTube video of it in action, which I think is enough.
It looks quite fun, I have to say.
It does. It's like one of these frenetic shooty games where you're overhead view and you just, have carpet
Shoot
bombs
absolutely playing. Everything Excellent. Until it blows up.
Yeah, it's one of those... Get rid of your aggression type
Suitable
games.
For children. Marvellous. Glad to hear it.
Yes. Is it a picture of a spaceship on the box? Or
I'm not sure you get a box through the software centre. I'm not
I
sure
really
if there's
cottoned onto this, have I?
App get box.
Yeah. Maybe I don't understand these things. Okay, what's up next, Mark?
The Ubuntu UK local community team, along with many other teams, are planning to go before the Loco Council for reapproval sometime before the Oneric release.
Oneric release, yes.
Now, this is a regular thing, isn't it, for Loco teams?
Yeah, it started about a year ago. The Loco Council, which I'm on, were asked to reapprove Loco teams. So there's a process by which we can approve Loco teams and say, hey, look, we recognise you do fantastic advocacy work, and we recognise that what you're doing is valuable to the community and valuable to Ubuntu as a project, so we'll mark you as an approved team, and therefore there are some benefits that you get as being an approved team. Not least, you know, recognition that, you know, your peers have noted that it is a good set of work you're doing, but you also get some free stuff from Canonical, like CDs and stuff.
Right.
And recently they decided that actually what had happened is loads of teams had been approved, but then they just carried on being approved, whether that status was still approved, whether they carried on doing stuff or not.
Right.
So we decided to go through a reapproval process to make sure that everyone's still keeping up, you know, the good work.
So if a team is really keen and then drops off, at some point they'll become unapproved.
Yes. And they're approved. When you get approved, you're approved for 2 years.
Right.
And so when it comes around to reapproval time, we'll look back over the last 2 years, see what's been done. And you need to document that. You know, you need to create a wiki page, which is a reapproval page, which lists all the things you've done and also the things you've got planned for the next 2 years.
Okay, cool. So is that something that people need to help out with? Or?
Well, actually, right now there's a meeting. I think it's probably just about finished as we're recording this, online, where they're kind of discussing how to get the reapproval application together.
Okay.
But yeah, it's being discussed on the UK mailing list. And if you've done anything within the UK as part of the Loco team, then by all means, jump on the mailing list and let us know. And we'll put some links to where you can gather this information.
And I see we get a reference, as does OgCamp.
Yeah, because it's created by members of the Loco team. So, you know, it's a useful resource.
That's OgCamp.
Oh, Mark's woken up. Right, and that's all in the bit about Ubuntu this time. And it's time for your feedback. Mike Burrows emailed in to say,
following up on the request from your Spanish speaker listening in Series 4, Episode 9, Brave New World, if you don't have the opportunity to edit, e.g. if it's a live show, probably the biggest win you can get in control over dynamic range is in maintaining fixed distances between the sound source and the microphones. If everyone is prepared to use headset mics, then the fixed distance from mouth to mic will keep the level settings correct, even if people blithely elect to move their heads while you're recording.
Yeah.
Love the show, volume discontinuities and all. See you all at OgCamp.
Well, thank you, Mike, and look forward to seeing you at OgCamp too. We did actually consider sort of Britney-style headsets. I think when Dave was on the show in particular, he had a, he had a habit of wandering off mic quite a lot, didn't he?
I think we all do it to varying degrees.
What you're talking about, Alan.
Yeah, very funny. Yeah, we do, and we're going to be trying harder. I spent some time yesterday twiddling with all the settings and things. Hopefully this one will sound a bit better, and we'll try our best.
Plus, we're not doing this one live. So.
And, of course, Tony has actually fixed us all in position against our mic so that we cannot move.
To be honest, I fail to see how you could be off mic in this setup, but, yeah, the neck braces help, don't they?
Yes.
Jonathan Nadeau emailed in response to last show's segment about accessibility.
First, I would like to thank you for covering accessibility in Linux. I'm a blind Linux user myself, and this is an important topic to go over, but I would like to make some comments on what Alan Bell was saying about the latest release of Ubuntu. He made it sound like there were a few problems, but other than that, everything else seemed to work, which is not the case. The Orca screen reader does not work with Unity at all. You cannot get to where the network manager is located in order to connect to a wireless network. Also, even once you connect to the network with Sighted Help, Firefox doesn't work with the Orca screen reader and you are unable to surf the web. The only thing that can be done by the Unity desktop is to open up LibreOffice and create a Word document. Accessibility matters and shouldn't be taken lightly. I wish that Ubuntu would have put more thought into Unity before switching and breaking all accessibility in GNOME. Thanks for the podcast and keep up the great work.
Thanks for the feedback. I know Jonathan does do a lot of work in selling systems that have accessibility enabled Linux distros. So he is a bit of an expert in this area.
So this is, I mean, obviously really good feedback for the Unity team to think about how they continue to make that desktop environment particularly accessible. And also, of course, I mean, okay, we can say, well, okay, at the moment the answer is fortunately you can fall back to the older style desktop, but going forward we kind of seriously need to focus on that to make this as broadly as acceptable by people as possible.
Okay. Yeah.
I've got a question then. Does it matter that it's so badly broken in this release because we call these development releases?
No, we don't.
No, we don't. People say, oh, it's just a development release, but there's never any, you know, when we release it, Canonical don't say, this is a development release, by the way. They say, this is a new release of Ubuntu.
I've been at UDS when Canonical employees have called these cowboy releases. Right. The one after LTS is always a cowboy release, meaning that, you know, it's a bit rough around the edges, it might be a bit broken. Yeah. And that was stamped on pretty much straight away by his management, which was, no, we don't do cowboy releases, we don't do development releases. Development releases are alpha, beta before we do the final release. But said, it is the case that stuff isn't fully polished in non-LTS releases, and LTSs tend to be more polished.
Okay, let me rephrase that then. Perhaps, does it matter as much that this, because this isn't an LTS release, that there's stuff in it that doesn't yet work, presuming that there is then a commitment to make it work in future releases?
Well, there was a bug filed about something accessibility related. I can't remember which specific aspect it was, but I know Mark Shuttleworth left a comment on the bug that said basically, yes, we didn't have time in this cycle because it was very aggressive to get Unity done for 11.04.
Right.
You know, we've kind of dropped ball on that, so we're going to have to try harder in the next release. And we have one more release, and then 12.04 is LTS. So if it's not great in 11.10, then it really should be good by 12.04 because that's LTS.
Yeah, and hopefully Jonathan and the people he worked with are filing bugs on these things. And
well, as I said last time, Alan and I and a few others, we did a cooperative run through of the Ubuntu install, just the installer, with the screen turned off to see what it was like and see if it was possible to do an install. And it's pretty horrible, you know. It's not really possible for one person who has, you know, limited or no sight to do an install. So yeah, there is some stuff that's pretty badly broken in this release.
And you're coming to it with some familiarity with the installation process.
Yeah, exactly. I've seen it before.
You know the screen reader is there.
Exactly. Yeah.
For example.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, but even with the screen turned off, you know, you move the mouse around and the labels on things are just completely incomprehensible garbage because it's designed to look pretty. It's not designed to be accessibility enabled, unfortunately. So, yeah, we need to do better on that.
It's designed to look pretty.
Yes.
Okay, that's the main design point.
Exactly. Well, okay, that is a design consideration, yeah.
Fair enough.
And finally, Rich Wareham sent an email for the attention of the Wing Commander.
It was ironic that the WC was berating you for not being au fait with classical languages, since the entire Latin segue was started by him saying how aneric was a word of Latin root. Of course, you and I all know that it is from the Greek word aneiros, meaning dream. Interesting, there is a Latin word. Thank you, everybody, for giving me this one. There is a Latin word onerosus from onus or ona, which means burdensome or burden. The root of our word onerous. Perhaps the WC is suggesting that aneric ocelot will be a burden on his system.
We can only wait for feedback from the
I'm amused and bemused that the Ubuntu UK podcast has become, you know, the way for the WC to interact with his fans. It's vice versa.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much indeed for all of your feedback, but that about wraps it up for this time. That's all for this episode. Thank you for listening. You can find out how to get in touch with us on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org, including voicemail numbers and Twitter feeds, Facebook and IRC channels. We've reached the magic 600 mark on Facebook now, by the way.
And also, 1.5 million downloads.
Yes, we've had 1.5 million downloads since we started.
That's amazing.
Which is about 20,000 per episode or something like that.
Yeah, that's crazy. Let us know what you think of the show, all 1.5 million downloads of it, or give us your thoughts about Ubuntu and the community around it. Join us on Tuesday the 19th of July for our next live episode. So anyway, remains to say thank you to Andy for coming and being our guest presenter.
Yes,
this
thank
episode.
You very much.
Have
thank
you had you. A good time?
I do. I always have a good time here, Tony, so thank you for inviting me again.
I think both times you've had a good time.
That is true, yes.
That's good. Yeah, and so we'll be back for with another live show on Tuesday the 19th, back to the live episodes, and we'll hope you join us then.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.